Welcome to Lessons from Disruptors, Game Changing Startups. Our hashtag, if you're tweeting, is SXDisruptSU. I'm Harry McCracken. I'm an editor-at-large with Time, and we have three panelists who represent three companies that have definitely disrupted their industries. To my right is Travis Bogard, who is VP of Product Management and Strategy at Jawbone. Next to him is Matt Rogers, who is a founder and vice president of engineering at Nest. And on the far end is Ren Eng, who is founder and CEO at Litro. I wanted to start by asking you guys just a couple of questions, one of which is, how many of you are currently work at a startup? Quite a few, but not everybody. How many of you are at least interested in the idea of doing a startup at some point? Quite a few again. How many of you know about Jawbone? And how about Nest? And finally, Litro. Great. So I had an opening question for the panelists, which is sort of one of the basic questions, which is, did your companies set out to be disruptive, and is that even a reasonable goal for a new company to try to shake up an established industry? Starting with you, Travis.
Sure. Yeah, I'll kick us off here. You know, I think disruption is not really the primary goal. I think it's a outcome that ends up coming out of really the focus being around solving a user problem. You know, really looking at how people are living and how you can go affect and change that. There was actually a recent Kauffman Foundation put out a study that said the startups that last beyond 5 years, half of them were actually founded by user entrepreneurs, essentially entrepreneurs trying to start a company to solve a problem rather than trying to just build a business. And I think that's really the key to creating that disruption, because ultimately if you're solving a real problem that other people are missing, you're going to end up setting apart from the industry, and that's where the disruption ends up coming into play.
And Jawbone, we should mention, has been around for a while. You've been through multiple generations and have expanded into other product categories.
Yeah, and the original vision was how to build voice interfaces to mobile devices, effectively what Siri is doing now. And in the process of trying to solve that problem, we started trying to figure out how do we know perfectly when someone's speaking and when they're not to make speech recognition actually work better. Turned out that was actually one of the biggest breakthroughs in communications in the past 30 years, and that's what led to the noise assassin technology built into the headsets. And so really started with that idea of building mobile interfaces and making that experience better. And we've extended that into mobile lifestyle, essentially all these things that we're carrying around, the world that's been enabled by these iPhones and Android devices that we carry around. How can we make that experience better and bring it to life? So if you think about, you know, the goal of this getting down to glass and very thin, well, this is content as well. It's music, it's movies and films and games. You want to be able to bring that to life, and that's where, you know, something like the Jambox comes into play. So these two work in concert together, and that's sort of the vision, is how do we tie that mobile lifestyle together and how people are moving around throughout their life and make that experience better.
Cool. Matt, you and your co-founder, Tony, had an amazing run at a disruptive company, Apple, doing the iPod. And a couple of years ago, you started Nest?
Yeah, so actually, we set out to be incredibly disruptive. I mean, like, the industry we're attacking is kind of old and sleepy and dumb and really hasn't changed in 30 years. So we set out to turn it on its head and see where along the chain we could innovate. And it turns out it's basically everywhere. I mean, from user interface and where you buy it to how it's packaged, how it's produced, the how you install it on the wall, how you use it day to day. Like, kind of from end to end, we looked at how to disrupt it. And, I, you know, back to what Travis was saying about user experience, that was kind of the paramount. That's kind of what we, the capstone on top of the company is how can we improve the user experience, you know, across the entire experience with thermostats. I mean, this is a industry like ripe for disruption. It's kind of one of those things when you start a company that you look to do something that everybody has. You know, everyone's got one. It's inefficient, horrible experience. It's a, you know, one of those kind of markets that startups love to see. I mean, that's, as an entrepreneur, that's what you look for, right? It's, yeah, definitely. I think it was core to what we started with.
And did you start out saying let's be disruptive, or did you start out saying let's build a thermostat?
We started out with let's build a thermostat, but it, you know, as we looked into the thermostat space, it was obvious that we would be shaking a lot of very big trees. And you know, yeah, as you guys may or may not know, that we definitely shook a very big tree.
Ren, you had an idea which you worked on in an academic background, and at what point did you say, I might be able to take this disruptive idea of light field photography and go up against, you know, these companies that have been in the photography business for decades in most cases?
I think for me and for Lytro, it was really when we committed to building our own product and doing an end-to-end visual storytelling product for people where you could take pictures of the new kind of camera and share it online with your friends and family so that they could enjoy it as well, a new kind of interactive picture. That's when we realized that we had something that could really disrupt this industry. But when I started out of academia, this was based on my dissertation at Stanford. For me, it was a very different kind of a space. It was really started with a goal to make a contribution to society. And for me, my research started with studying something called a light field in computer graphics, which is one of the most influential ideas in the field, one of the foundations of theoretical computer graphics now. And on the other side, spending all my time, my free time, doing photography. I'm very passionate about cameras and picture taking. All my best friends are rock climbers that like to take pictures. So trying to solve problems in my own photography with the kind of cameras that I was using by applying the concepts from computer graphics was how I got going. And it was with a knowledge that was sort of not unique, but very much pocketed in computer graphics and photography that I saw that we could really make an amazing change to the kind of photography and visual storytelling that we share with one another by connecting these two really large things. It was only later when we came across, well, it's hard to get an old ossified industry to do a transformational thing because transformational things are disruptive and therefore risky to large industries, that we realized that a transformational technology requires a transformational product and a new company in order to really bring all the benefits to the world. So that's what we set out to do.
Did you consider trying to license technology to Canon or Nikon or somebody who's in the business already, or did you say this needs to be a disruptive company?
We did, and I think that having something come out which calls into question the existing marketing platforms for an industry that's this big, the standalone camera company is a $40 billion a year in sales company industry, is a very risky thing for people to try to figure out what to do. So the point is not to introduce it as another feature or another bullet that can introduce another source of control, but to make a more complicated cameras, because cameras are way complicated enough. And so to take the technology and use it as an unfair advantage to really simplify the camera and simplify the experience of sharing better pictures, more engaging pictures with people, was something that it's very clear, I think, that the incumbents are not going to do.
One thing all three of your companies have in common is that you're all hardware companies, which is fairly unusual because historically the mortality rate for hardware companies has been extremely high, and you're all building not only a device but also software and a service that all integrate. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether that gives you an advantage, even though it's probably more challenging to build the whole package than it would be to say we're going to design a platform and license it to somebody else?
Yeah, I think hardware is definitely hard, and that's what's kept people out of it. But I think, to the point about licensing, that's how Jawbone actually started out. We started out trying to license this technology to other companies, and we found a lot of pushback. We, people were saying, well, that's going to cost too much to put it in. It's, we need to change the industrial design too much. And we, through that process, truly walked the Alan Kay quote of people serious about software need to build their own hardware, and we very much believe that. And by building up the skill sets of being able to create hardware as well as software, we're able to deliver a complete experience that's coherent for the user. And so I think that's an important thing. I think people are seeing what's possible as companies like ours and others are out there doing that and delivering really refined experiences. And I think that's interesting. Now, I think what's also happened is the barrier to entry for hardware has sort of gone down as ODMs have come around and things like that. But I think the barrier to great hardware has not actually gone down, and it's giving a sort of false sense of hope to some people. And I think, getting hardware, getting the, what you see up here in terms of these beautiful products refined down and making those cost trade-offs and putting the money back into the product, those are not easy decisions to go make. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where you really start to see a separation in some of the hardware companies that are getting created versus, you know, essentially what we're trying to do here.
Matt, I don't think people even thought of thermostats as platforms until you guys came along.
Yes. So, I mean, the way we see it is, you know, hardware, software, services. I couldn't imagine a world where you don't do those things. Mm-hmm. So you can't just build a hardware product, or in our cases, you can't just build a software product. You really have to build it all. I mean, in order to build the best experience out there, you have to own it all, and you have to kind of think of how all these pieces tie together, and how from when you install it and you pair it to your account, and when you control your temperature from your iPhone, how all these things work. It wouldn't work if we didn't do it the way we did it. I mean, looking at, I'd say, other people in our space. It just is. Their experience is not as good. I mean, you have to call your utility to get your thermostat paired. It's who's going to do these things? It doesn't make any sense. In terms of, you know, how hard it is, yes, it's incredibly difficult. It's, you know, so I'd say some of the most difficult engineering I've ever done. But it's, you know, I'd say it's a testament to our team. I mean, there is a large amount of incredibly talented engineers and designers in Silicon Valley. And all the training they've gotten at companies like Amazon and Google and Apple over the last 10 years has taught them how to build exceptional hardware products.
Ren, I mean, I imagine you sort of had to build everything because light field photography is new, and you had to create a file format and software that would work with that, and you had to build your own photo sharing service. Did you come to that conclusion pretty quickly?
Yeah, definitely. Light field technology requires a new kind of sensor. So the Lytro camera has a new kind of sensor inside it, a light field sensor that records all this information that's lost and missing in regular photographs. So you can't retrofit it into regular cameras because it's on the sensor surface. You can't build just software because it's collecting an entirely new kind of data inside this new camera. So it's clear that we had to build hardware. And the goal to not just have a new capture system that you could then do more with, you know, by adding some more sliders in Photoshop or something like that. Really, to take it to a new level, which is about a new kind of picture that makes a new kind of interactive, engaging experience that you can share with people that you love to show them the things that you love in a new kind of a way. This was, I think, a really natural path for us to go down because of the goals that I had from rock climbing and photography. We were taking pictures to try to make ourselves look cool, right? So this is just a sort of a natural progression. Coming to the question of, you know, hardware, software, and what's made this more possible today than it is in the past. And let's be really clear here. Hardware companies are much more doable today than they've ever been because of a number of changes in the industry that have really opened things up. There's things like commoditized manufacture, really cost-effective manufacture that startups can leverage. There's distribution channels, right? You can sell through the internet today. I mean, that was unthinkable 10 years ago. You can build a business selling through the internet. You can get the word out, right? 10 years ago, you'd have to buy a Super Bowl ad. These days, through social media marketing, very efficiently from the people that care to the people that they care about, the message can spread. And software, of course, we have an entirely new kind of picture format. But when many of you may have seen pictures on Lytro.com, or some of your friends may be starting to share pictures with you now, and you don't have to install any software on your mobile phone or in your browsers to see it, because the code that we have, our software to turn light fields into pictures, actually goes with these pictures through the web. And that is so disruptive for making it convenient to share this new kind of picture.
Has it been a challenge, the fact that light field photography is utterly new, and you know, no matter how much you know about a point-and-shoot camera, this is a new concept. So you have something that's unique, which is great, but is there an education process in general, both for the industry and for your consumers that you've had to go through?
Definitely. I think for us, this has been, I think for startups in general, when you have something that's really disruptive, having people understand what you're trying to do is one of the biggest challenges. I think for us, it's been something where we've got a lot of leverage out of the idea and how new it is, and it's also been a large challenge for us. The part that's great about it is that, you know, if I say to you or you say to any of your friends, hey, you know, check out this new kind of camera. I mean, better chances than not, like in the high 90%, in my experience, people want to say, oh, what's new about it? Because cameras, photography are so part of the human experience that people really want to know, I found. Now, at the same time, now you've got to explain why it's different, and it's collecting this multidimensional information and lets you make a new interactive kind of a picture and so on and so on and so forth. So there's layers in the story that need to come out. But that entry point for us is something that our team at Lytro, our marketing team, has just knocked it out of the park with, because I think from that kernel, people really care about imaging and photography.
Sticking with hardware for a second, another thing you have in common as companies is you all care about design. These are all good-looking products. It's clear that a lot of refinement went into them. And like you said, you know, refinement is hard. It's not easy, even though a lot of things have gotten easier. Can you talk a little bit about how you make products refined, but also the extent to which that's a differentiator in a world in which most products are not refined at all?
Sure. So in terms of, you know, how do you build a product that, you know, I'd say is well-designed? And, you know, everyone says they want to build products like Apple. I mean, that's probably one of the most common things they'll hear is, oh, I'm going to build this software, this hardware product. It's going to be like Apple. It turns out people who say that may not understand the kind of wherewithal you need in order to do that. So we, you know, at Nest, what we ended up doing is we built prototypes. We have our own designers. We iterate. And for this product here, we probably went through 300 iterations. And I think like 300 iterations of design, I mean, that's iterations where we have models. And you can see these models and say, I'd ship that product. And to take that product and say, I would ship that and throw it away is something that, yeah, I don't know how many people actually would end up doing. I mean, like, you know, to take something that you think is beautiful and say, it's not good enough yet. Let's keep going. Let's keep iterating. That lens isn't thick enough. That, you know, that the side isn't reflective enough. It takes a lot of effort. And you know, I would say it's something that is not only just, you know, emotionally intensive, but it's cost intensive. I mean, it will take time and energy and money to go build a design that's, you know, I would say it's attaining perfection. It's impossible to get to perfection, but what, you know, what you do as designers is continue to iterate and continue to refine. It's not genius. It doesn't just come to you in a dream saying it should look like this. It's hard work. It's just like writing code. You keep on iterating until you're satisfied with what you have.
Travis, your Bluetooth headsets probably compete with ones that are about a third the price in a lot of cases and are extremely commoditized. And I assume you're able to charge a lot more, at least in part because it's a far more elegant product.
Yeah, I mean, I think design, it's important to think about design as really, in order to get to great design, it has to be integrated into the company from a DNA perspective. It really starts at every decision you make throughout the process. It's also important to think about design isn't just about the skin of it. It's not about the aesthetics. It's that's one piece of it. But design is really thinking every last detail of this product, the user experience, how people are going to interact with it on a daily basis, how they're going to buy it and take it home and unbox it and go through that packaging and learn how to use it. So design touches every aspect of that, and it's about the intersection of that aesthetic with the functionality and how you can fuse those two together in an important way. And you know, I think, you know, a lot of the reason we charge more is not because we can afford through the design, is because we actually put the money into the product. And I think people then feel that they touch it when they, you know, grab one of the headsets and feel that difference. You know, we use medical grade plastic, which, you know, our partners think we're crazy because it's five times as expensive as regular plastic. The reason we do that is, you know, with a headset, if you're putting in your bag on an ongoing basis, or if you're a woman and you wear makeup, that cakes onto plastic over time. And with medical grade plastic, it's resistant to that. It preserves that look over time. Those are the types of things that are really important to users, people who live with this stuff on a daily basis. But as I said, it's a DNA thing. If you think about how you come to these decisions we're talking about, the ability to throw these prototypes away and go back and forth. An example with the Up product, we got to a place where functionality-wise, we could have launched about 6 months earlier. And you know, it was working, and we looked at it one day and we said, we think it needs to be 30% smaller before we can go back out. Start over, let's get it down to that point. We thought that was important because that's what we thought was form factor was important to get something that people would wear on an ongoing basis. how do you quantify that? That's impossible to do, right? I mean, that's like, why is this cut of jeans going to work on the runway and this one's not? It's purely a gut and artistic decision. And so you have to be able to have those people within the organization and the respect for those people to be able to say, these people are right and we're going to make a bet on that and be able to make those decisions to take the product out. And that's ultimately how design ends up having to permeate throughout the entire product experience.
So other than Apple, can you, each of you, talk a little bit about the companies that inspire you or the ones you look for lessons you can apply to your products?
Yeah, I can go. You know, I think I've been inspired by a lot of different things that over my life, I think that the one of the themes that has excited me the most is the intersection of science and art. And this comes from, you know, I'm sure many of you in high school or college, you know, took classes about the Renaissance, right? And this is just like was the quintessential time for the intersection of science and art elevating to something which really had a huge impact on society. And it's not a question of, you know, should it be just technology, should it be just aesthetics, but it's the merge of these two together that I think really brings some of the most influential and beautiful things that we have in life. And so some of the things that have really struck me, there's, you know, it's things like, if any of you have seen the skyline for Shanghai recently, in the last few years there's been a building by Mori that kind of looks like a shard of glass, and if you look on the side, it kind of looks like a bottle opener. There's a craftsmanship, and if you go inside the building, it's a craftsmanship that goes through the whole building, it permeates it. There's things like this. Back to the Renaissance, things like Michelangelo, right, to craft something like the David, you know, so tall, so much larger than a human being, out of a single block of marble, and to have the kind of precision, the kind of technical expertise to do that, and then the artistry to deliver that kind of an artifact. These are the kinds of things that you know, I think inspire all of us, and that I've drawn inspiration from to try to take the work that we do to the next level. And I think it's that commitment to craftsmanship. You know, it's a commitment to iterating and you know, making your bets on talent, on artistic talent, on engineering, innovation talent, to get all the best pieces together into a really compelling way. And it's not just a matter of programming. It's not just a matter of mechanical engineering. It is craftsmanship. And I think commitment to craftsmanship is something that's very important to Lytro.
I mean, one of the companies, you know, other than the three here that I think are quite inspiring, is what Flipboard's doing. So social media, in my opinion, is very noisy, and I have a lot of trouble looking at all these different things and knowing what's going on. So taking all of these feeds and distilling it down to something of kind of simplicity, you can flip through it, see the pictures, see some text, and very quickly know what's going on. That's, I think, is of incredible value. I mean, there's so much noise in kind of our daily lives with all these news feeds and inundation. So something that you can go to that simplifies it is exactly what kind of thing that I look for in my life. So it's an incredible product.
And I know Flipboard, they'll do 72 passes on an icon until it's just perfect, kind of in the same way you do with your hardware.
And another design team that came from Apple.
And you know, for us, I think if you think about a lot of the products we build, this mobile lifestyle, it is, you know, we are touching these devices and we're working together as a system. And I think, you know, what informs a lot of the decisions we make is how these work in concert. And so if you think about expectations users have, definitely the bar is raised and expectations are there. And when you want to go pair two things together, you can't have a drop off in that experience. You can't go from one piece that's really resolved and then you switch over to another product that's talking with it, and then all of a sudden it doesn't quite work the same way. And so that, I think, informs a lot of the decisions. But in terms of inspiration, you know, one of the things that you know, we thought a lot about with some of our new headsets that had more computing and even the Jambox was, how do we tie audio as part of that experience? And because that's a big piece of actually how you consume a product, how you interact with it. And if you think about BMW as an example, you can go back over many, many years And those doors have the same sound. You close that door, it consistently has the same sound over the past 20 years. And there's been some evolutions of it, but it carries that same design language. The ping of the engine is the same way. You hear one driving down the road, and you hear that same thing. And that's a lot of what we started thinking about is what are the sound profiles of these devices going to be? And when they turn on the Jambox, for instance, when it comes on, it has a thump. And it's very noticeable and identifiable as something that's us and belongs to us. And so we think about that was an inspiration of how you tie together that total experience within a total design language that includes aesthetics as well.
Great. Well, we would like to start taking some questions from the audience. And if any of you have one, if you could raise your hand, we'll bring around a microphone. There's somebody right up front.
Hi.
We'll bring a mic around to you.
No. Why? I'm just wondering, with all the things you can disrupt, how did you guys zero in on the Nest idea?
Say again?
Why Nest? Why not something else?
Ah.
Why Thermometer? Like, why not something else?
Why the name or why the product?
Why the product?
Oh, okay. So it's actually is the easiest question to answer. Because why would you leave Apple to go build a thermostat? The answer is it's half of home energy. So most people don't even know this, that on average, half of the energy in the home is basically controlled by the thermostat. And there are all these companies looking at how do I solve the energy crisis? People are wasting so much money on energy. How can I help them? Well, it turns out that white plastic box in your wall is charging you $200 a month. Yeah, it's kind of an astonishing number. And it was an obvious kind of opportunity that looking at that, where can we optimize? All the way from the user experience down to the algorithms, the technology behind it.
There was one comment about kind of iterating and then not launching. If you can all speak to that, that'd be great, because we keep hearing about, build it and just get it out there.
But
if you can all talk to that, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I am not a fan of the agile startup model, especially when you're doing something as high dollar and as important as a thermostat, something that controls your heating and cooling. I mean, we did not want to launch prematurely. It's one of those kind of things where we wanted to get it right. And someone installs it in their home. It controls their heating. Having them call our support center at midnight because they're cold is not something we want to happen. So we put a lot of time into the engineering. And on the design side, it's one of those things you have to have the kind of cojones to put up with it, right? To be able to take all these great designs that you could ship and say it's not good enough yet. We need to keep going. We need to keep iterating. And there comes a point where you see the product and you show it to somebody and say, that's a beautiful product. And that's how it's time.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to add on to that. I think the world has changed a bit in two forms. One is, I think the software element of that, people were starting to put out stuff, develop out in the public, and take that prototyping and feedback. I think this has changed a lot of that. You have a huge drop-off if you're building an app, and you go from the very resolved internal apps that are there and all the 400,000 other apps that work really well, and then your app isn't quite there. And Flipboard's a good example of that, where they waited to launch until it was very resolved as part of that. I think ultimately in hardware, that's even more important. It takes a lot of time and effort to build up channels, put inventory out there and things like that. And you really have one cycle to get that right in people's minds. And so it's what's most important is not being first. It's being first to get it right. And I think you will buy yourself a ton of market credit if you just wait for that point and get it right. So,
Ran, I know that you have plans to do far more with light field photography than is expressed in this first product, and you've been working on this idea for many years. How did you decide when the timing was right to go to market and when you had a product that would please people?
The timing to go to market was as soon as possible. And for us, we had to learn enough things as a company to figure out how to put all the pieces together to put out a hardware product, because there's a lot of sophistication in a business that's that complicated. And I'm a first-time entrepreneur, and so it took time for for me to mature and for the company to mature enough for us to get something like that out. But the pieces that really came together for us were, as I talked about earlier, learning about the manufacturing chain, the distribution chain, how we would get word out through the web, and seeing opportunities arise for us to bring it out quickly. Come back to the question about sort of iterations or design methodology. You know, ship first and fix later does not work for hardware, right? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the easy place for hardware. And I think there are different approaches that can work for different spaces in software that are more flexible. So Agile is something that's, I think, become, you know, obviously a lot more popular these days. I think that kind of goes to the other side around craftsmanship. And I was talking about earlier. And so my thoughts on this have evolved quite a bit recently, where personally, I always iterate a lot before putting things out. I've always been this way. My dissertation is done this way. If any of you ever try to typeset something, you might like a book by Bringhurst called it's called The Elements of Typography or something like this. But it, you know, if you read the book, it's very, very self-referential because it's a book on typography. And as you turn from page to page, obviously there's beautiful spacing and beautiful letter forms and block out to the page. But he talks about the craftsmanship of, as you turn a page, having the rhythm of the page, that those lines intersect from one side of the paper to the other, so that when you turn, there's a precision to the presentation of the design of the pages from page to page. These kinds of ideas, I think, can really instill deeply into companies. And I've always operated this way from sort of an instinctual perspective, or who knows where things come from, but maybe it was from my parents saying when I was young, you know, if it's worth doing well, it's worth doing well. Who knows where these things come from, but it's always been deeply ingrained in me. And in the company, I think I've been going through a phase of learning about many of these other approaches, such as things that are more agile, put things out earlier. And my pendulum is swinging back towards the side of craftsmanship first, intuition, learning from the community in order to develop the intuition that you need, but then driving from intuition and with a commitment to craftsmanship before ship. But I think there are many different models that can work for different people.
I also think there's an intersection of those two, right? I mean, you can be doing an agile development model internally, and you know, so a lot of what we're talking about is that choice of releasing and shipping. And so, you know, I think it's very important to the prototyping and iteration to be spinning things as fast as possible, learning from it and pivoting off that. And that only happens through more of an agile type internal model. And so I think that's very important, and you have to build up internally the set of trusted set of people who can give good feedback and be part of that cycle and help you learn.
Yeah, but you don't want to ship a prototype. It just doesn't work.
More questions from the audience? Yes.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about finding investors and financial backers who share your commitment to craftsmanship.
So to repeat the question, how do you find people who can finance that, who share the vision you have and the willingness to do something disruptive?
Sure, I'll start. So, I mean, a lot of it, what it comes down to is reputation. So, I mean, this is not just hardware, but software as well. VCs and investors look for teams that have done it before and kind of a history of being able to execute. I mean, I don't know what the statistic is, but most startups change. Like, you know, they have this idea that they pitch, and that's not the idea they end up shipping. They pivot. And that's kind of the foundation of what it is to start a company. So when it comes to, you know, how do you get funding, it's what your team is. Like, you know, who's on your team, what have they done, how does this team see they're going to execute on this plan. You know, planning is important, but you know, we know plans change.
Ren, you did not have a background of other successes in entrepreneurship. You had a great idea, and how did you get the funding you needed? Did you hire folks who did come from a company background?
I had a gentleman, his name is Manu Kumar, and he now has a microcap venture fund called K9 Ventures. And so he showed me how to get going, and actually not just showed me how to get going, but he dragged me kicking and screaming into starting the company, actually. And so I've been very grateful to him, and he's become a dear friend. And I think that the commitment to craftsmanship and how to find investors in this space, at least for me, it was completely disconnected from the investor process. It might be different for Nest and perhaps for Jawbone too, but I think it really comes from internal within the team, the DNA that Travis was talking about before. I think if you have commitment to craftsmanship and it permeates everything that you do, from the time that you spend on the slides that you present, you know, the level of detail to the design and presentation there, to the very words that you choose to articulate the ideas and distilling those down to their, you know, their richest form, this is craftsmanship too. And I think it permeates the whole expression of what you as an individual and your organization will present to investors or for anyone for that matter through customers and externally. And so I think it starts there. The question of whether it's going to affect an investor or not, it really comes down to whether you can execute within a deadline. Right. So, look, if you just iterate forever to try to make things more perfect, then craftsmanship is great. But if you don't ship, then the business will fail, I mean, by definition. So it's got to be within a time box. But I think time box craftsmanship within a time box is absolutely doable and is just part of the reality of, you know, of getting things out.
Travis, any advice?
You know, I think it does start all with the team, as the rest of the guys are saying here, and I think the investors also get it. You know, to your direct question about, you know, how do you find investors who care? It helps that the most valuable company in the world is Apple, and who really set this idea of design out there. So they get it, but it's not okay to go and say, hey, we're going to go be Apple, right? You have to come in and say, here's what we see is not working. Here's why people are going to care about this, and here's what we're going to go do to fix that. And if that makes sense and you've thought through every last detail and can, you know, succinctly summarize that, then, you know, people will say, yes, let's put money on this. I believe that can go change. And, you know, as we were talking about here, it will pivot 50 times. And so it's really about understanding that this team knows how to look at the problem set, knows how to look at users, and can go find a solution to build into that.
We have a question in the middle there.
Thank you. Obviously, your hardware is extremely disruptive, but as someone who works in crisis communications and reputation management, and from some of my own personal experiences, some of the most disruptive work you're doing is on the customer service side. How the issues with the up band were handled, I benefited from that. I took a picture of my thermostat and said, how do I install this thing? And I got an email back the same day. Is that something you think all companies can be doing? Are you in a special position because of your size? You know, why are... What do you think you're doing differently, and is it something you think you'll be able to continue to do as you get bigger?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, it goes to this commitment to the user experience, and that's kind of the core, you know, as I said earlier. And that user experience is not just when you use the product or the marketing you do before you buy the product, but how you engage the customer after they buy the product. It's actually more important. You know, I don't know if you guys know in terms of how things spread. So, like, when someone's excited about your company, their promoter, you know, they discuss it. But when someone's really angry with their purchase and are upset, they're demoter, and that spreads much further. And it has actually, it's the most detrimental to your company and to your brand. So, making sure that those people who have experiences where they need support, we get them that as soon as possible is so important. Especially, you know, as products are more and more core to your being, your home. You know, like, if your heat goes down, we need to have someone come out there and check it out. I mean, it makes perfect sense, and it doesn't cost a lot to do this. I mean, it's just a matter of effort. You know, we have someone whose job it is to be on Twitter and Facebook and see what people are saying, and if people have questions, to respond to them. It's the beauty of this modern age of social media that we're in, and to be able to do that. And for companies not to do that, I think is a fallacy. I mean, you need to do that. And in terms of kind of the more broad customer support, it's just a matter of, you know, staffing and optimization. If you have a great product and you stand behind that product, the support side is not that difficult. I mean, I guess the more important side here is if there are issues, you feed them back in the product and you fix them. So, and then you don't have the customer support challenges.
Travis, can you talk a little bit about the launch of the up wristband and the initial response and how you reacted?
Yeah, I mean, when we launched up, we had phenomenal response. I mean, the product, you know, was flying off shelves beyond velocity we've seen of anything else. You know, huge interest. And through that feedback cycle, we started seeing some people having some issues. And we, you know, when we looked at that, and especially in this market and any market that we look at, but we saw that this is such a new market. And we said, you know, as I said before, what's important is not being first, it's being first to get it right. And we said, we don't want this market to, you know, have the first experience have this varying experience. And so we said, look, let's put pause on this and let's, you know, make sure that, you know, if you have a complaint about a pixel in the layout or whatever, it doesn't matter what the complaint is, you have full refund, you know, guarantee behind our product. And so we thought that was important as we're creating a new category here and creating that experience. And, you know, to the point of customer experience, it's, it's tied into that entire product life cycle. It's they're one and the same. How you're setting it up, how you're getting it going is important. And even within our company, we actually just recently put customer experience as part of the product team. So they are very inextricably linked because, again, if you're going to create products, you need to understand the impact if you're not doing a good job at every last detail, and you need to think about that. And so that's how we've been thinking about it and continuing to run it.
Cool. Ren, are you starting to get questions and feedback from actual consumers now?
We are, and I think that the web these days, has made it so much easier to communicate with customers, which is a terrific thing. Of course, it's also an echo chamber, so customers are communicating with the world as well. And I think that's a great thing because then it drives attention to these things in a way where, perhaps in the past, before communication was as transparent as it is these days, it might be easier to disregard customer complaints, but it might also be really hard to know about customer complaints for lots of products, right? So I think that's the modernity of the web is a crucial part to be able to take customer experience to a new level. And for us, we just started shipping about less than 2 weeks ago. And for me, the experience of seeing customers take their own pictures and to be able to, wake up in the morning and sort of sit in bed and on my phone, say, oh, that's an interesting link and look at some pictures that people are taking is just such a terrific thing. And I've been really excited to get out into the world to shoot with people on some of these photo walks that we have. We've been running a bunch of photo walks for early customers or customers that are thinking about buying the product. And to get hands-on with people and to show them some of the things that I've learned about live view photography has been something that I've really cherished.
The other thing is, since all three of us, we talked a lot about software and services, how they're integrated, that feedback that you get, many of those things you can actually go address. When we launched Jambox, we built in, it would tell you when it was running out of battery. And we got some funny stories where people would call us up and they'd say, hey, my wife's home alone, it's 2 in the morning, and all of a sudden, she heard a voice in the other room. And it turns out it was the Jambox saying, recharge me now. So that was the type of thing that we, created an update for it, pushed it out. Every, Jambox owner was able to get it for free. They just plugged it in and did that. Those are the types of things by having a combined software, hardware solution you can do. And also, if you're watching the forums, watching Twitter and all the other places where this feedback comes in, you'll notice and can address really early on in that product rather than, people being frustrated, saying, hey, I love this product except for this one little thing. You can go address those little things. And I think that's really important.
We have a question near the back.
Yeah, thanks. This has been a great talk. My takeaway from the lean and agile models that you guys were talking about isn't necessarily that people need to release their products, especially with tangible products, as early as possible, but to get it in front of customers as early as possible. So could you guys talk about what your process is for before you actually do your release, how you get it in front of customers and what that testing process is like and what kind of feedback you get and how that fits into your methodology?
How do you beta test your stuff?
For us, it's first is ourselves. Like, we dog food everything we do, from new hardware to new software to new web and mobile apps. We do it all ourselves. And then once we're satisfied, we actually have 200 to 300 people around the country who are beta testers for us, and we roll out new software to their homes, and they give us feedback directly, and we iterate there until it's baked, until our bug count is zero. And then we say, I think this release is ready, and then we'll ship it out. It's one of the things we're agile internally, but we're definitely not agile externally.
Yeah, and this goes back to what I was talking about before about, user-driven entrepreneurs. I think we'll see those things very early on. And so, we have a lot of people. We're not building, enterprise stuff here. We're building consumer products. Every single person in our company is a consumer. And, we notice those things. And what you end up having to really focus on is, those things that you're sort of noticing, you need to really drill into and say, that's not, good enough. We need to fix those. And it's challenging for a lot of companies like ours who, tend to be very secretive. So you, until we launch. And so, it's really finding those trusted individuals who notice those things. We have a couple of people in our office. We like to say they break everything. They just, it touches their hands and immediately they find every last flaw in it. And, being able to seek those people out and find them and put stuff into their hands early helps with that learning cycle very early on.
Does your hardware evolve during this process, or are you tweaking the software by this point?
both. I mean, all of the above. Like I said, with Up, we got to the point where we said hardware needs to get 30% smaller. I mean, that's not an overnight change. That's not just shave some edges. That's, you know, relaying out boards and retooling and doing things like that. So it's, you know, nothing is off limits before you've shipped.
How much did Lytro evolve during the testing phase?
Sorry, ask again.
How much did your camera and your service evolve during the testing phase after the rough draft was ready?
A fair amount. The material choices, internal layouts, all of these things iterate a lot on the hardware and a lot on the software side. For us, we were very much building the company and the engineering team in concert with doing the product. And I think this is perhaps a space where for Lytro it's been a bit different than perhaps for Nest and maybe to a lesser extent for Jawbone. But for us, one of the big challenges is that when you're doing a whole new image processing pipeline, this is a very, very, you know, distributed and challenging engineering pipeline to put together. And at the end, everybody in the world is an expert because everybody looks at pictures, and the human visual system is just phenomenal. So if there's any little thing that's wrong, anybody in the world can tell you about it. And the problem is that, you know, there's probably, like, depending on how you count, like 24 pieces from optics through to a sensor, through an electrical system, through an image processing pipeline on the camera. Do you get off the camera? There's a whole bunch of software to make pictures and share them. And all of them need to be working correctly in order to make a picture that that an everyday person, any person, will tell you is a good picture. And so for us, the bring-up process of this pipeline and all the components being optimized in parallel makes it very hard to get user feedback, had made it very hard to get user feedback to get to the right kind of issues that we can continue to change. Because if the picture doesn't look right, then that's the first distraction, and it's very hard to get a user past that. So we ran, you know, lots of, as many, as Travis and Matt described, as many different opportunities to learn as possible, a number of stages of alpha and, you know, beta releases, internal reviewers and things like this, pro photographer programs. But at the same time, a lot of the polish comes at the finish line as things cascade towards a really polished outcome. And so a lot of it, at the end of the day, drives from intuition. And so one of the things I found that I do a lot in the company, having spent a lot of time with cameras and photography, being very intimate with the technology, of course, is to try to keep a steady, steady mindset for the key individuals that need to understand what we're shooting towards, have the confidence that we will get there if we build it and iterate it and polish it enough, and also for the folks that need to understand to communicate about it, where we will land. And that's been a really interesting, challenging aspect of our product development process.
Another question towards the middle, I think, or anywhere else? More questions, folks? Towards the back there.
Yeah, I love all three products, and particularly this question has to do with Nest. You mentioned that you didn't want to own the whole thing. In terms of working with channels or working with partners, you have to work with, whether it's electrical companies, what are the difficulties there, and where did you decide to stop? You know, where did you decide to not become an electrical company? Because particularly with that one, I would have a hard time, how do we stop and to create a great user experience?
Yeah, so there's some areas where you know, it doesn't make sense for us to invent, like manufacturing. Like, we're not going to go build a factory. So, you know, actually, like, speaking to what was difficult, that was actually very difficult. You know, in our previous life, we would go to companies in Asia and say, we're going to go build 25 million of this. You know, you guys are in, you're going to pay X dollars. This situation was quite a bit different in that, you know, like, we were, at the time, three guys pitching companies in Asia saying, hey, you know us, we've worked together, we built these products together with you guys before, you know, take a bet on us. You know, we're going to go build this industry together. It's not a smartphone, it's not a tablet, it's a totally new industry, and you guys are going to want to be a part of this too. And that was not so easy. I mean, like having to go back to those beginnings and I'd say start with a new engineering team and all those things from scratch is hard. And it's not something that we would have had to do at Apple. At Apple, all those things are established. And I'd say on the channel side, you definitely don't want to, like, well, it depends on what stage you're in. Like what Apple did with the Apple Store made sense. But a company of our size, it doesn't make sense to reinvent the channel. I mean, there's great consumer channels out there today, like Best Buy, where people know to go buy great products. So it makes sense to be on those stores.
How's the response been to Nest from contractors and wholesalers? And I have these visions of like a cigar chomping contractor who's kind of skeptical about the whole idea. And is that true? Or
so we've seen the whole spectrum. So on one end we see those who are upset because we're disrupting the business model. You know, that they can't charge as much as they were and taking as much margin as they used to. On the other side, we see people who are incredibly excited because they get to engage with a new class of customer and they get to acquire new customers. They get to go into people's houses and install thermostats that they may not have got to speak to before. And you know, that's been, you know, it's been an excellent guy, you know, new customer acquisition technique for these guys.
Any other questions from the floor? Did you see somebody?
There
we go.
In the back,
thanks.
I had a question around how you're dealing with the challenges of balancing cost of production, your margins, and essentially quality, and referencing things like GE's lawsuits against Samsung, saying that they're building refrigerators so poorly that they're beating out price, and that's kind of disrupting and disturbing the market and using sort of a negative disruption to get there. So how do you manage the balance between cost, margin, and build quality?
So it's very simple. Build quality first. I mean, like going back to the kind of what your founding principles of your company. If your founding principle is quality and user experience, that has to come first, even at the cost of margin. And customers will pay for a better product. I mean, that's been obvious. I mean, Nest is $249, which is on average much higher than thermostats today. But people will pay for it because it's a much better product. So, I mean, when it comes down to it, I mean, never sacrifice quality. It's something that people will see immediately, and you know, the customers see right through that. You can't ship crap.
And that will depend on your stage of product evolution, too. And I think, you know, when you're in market creation, you're sort of creating the new categories, you're very much in that land of you're probably going to have low margin because you're just getting it right. And, you know, as I said before, put the money into the product. You're going to drive the cost up because you're putting the money in there, but people are going to see and value that. You know, I know when we launched Jambox at $200, you know, a lot of skepticism was, you know, will people spend $200 on a speaker? And, you know, we're now the number one selling speaker in the U.S. because we put that money in quality into the product. And that's what drove that price point. Over time, you know, as you understand your inventory levels and you know, throughput and things like that, you can then go back and, you know, buy ahead and negotiate and things like that. But, you know, starts out exactly what Matt was saying, which is just get it right and put it all back into the product.
Ren, how did you think about those issues?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been the same for us. When you're starting out, it's very difficult to know what BOM you're going to arrive at, what bill of material cost is going to be, especially if you're a first-time startup and you haven't worked with manufacturers in a space before. And so I think going after what the user experience is going to be, what the product experience will be, will answer most of the questions, and then pricing comes after this. Of course, you have to have an envelope of where you're trying to strike and be market relevant. But you know, as an example, in the Lytra camera, the entire front section of this camera, this RIT section here, is all lens. And this is a very expensive thing to do and is totally unprecedented in the market, definitely for consumer, for the point-and-shoot space, and even for, I would argue, for the higher-end cameras. And as a person that's been very passionate about photography and has done a ton of photography with DSLRs and other camera systems, I used to have a bag full of lenses to have the creative kind of, you know, possibilities for composition. The whole bag of lenses now is inside this camera. But this aperture at f2 for the photographers out there, you know, to 35 to almost 300 millimeters at f2 is really unprecedented in the market. Now, this is a hard thing for most folks that aren't familiar with the specifications to appreciate. So it's something that is not as easy to communicate, and it's, I think, the aspect that's been the least well appreciated in the review process about the product so far. But for the photographers that know and the pictures that come out, this is how this will radiate as the product continues to go out. So we've really, I think Travis put it really well, you know, put the money into the product, and people will know.
I had a question for all three of you, which is, even if you're not willing to talk about it, are you thinking 5 years out, 10 years out, and thinking about how to, not only to come in and be a disruptor, but to stay disruptive? In the case of Jawbone, I think you are, because I remember 5 years ago talking to your founder, and he didn't tell me exactly what you were going to do, but I knew that he had plans beyond building a nice headset. Mm-hmm. And are you thinking out to 5 years from now?
Yeah. So we think a little less in terms of the specifics of timing. We really have a vision, a long-term vision of how we're living and how it's fundamentally changing as we've become more mobile. And we think that's changing the landscape of our lives and thus the solutions we need in it. And so when we think about that, we have, you know, these day in the life slides. I think we've, you know, shown you a few of them and how we think life will change over time. And you know, at a macro level, I think that, you know, what I've talked a bit about that we're, you know, where I think we are today is really, in computing in general, is an extension of the Industrial Revolution, really about command and control and giving leverage to humans to do that. When we look forward and what starts happening as you have sensors and computing and technology around the person and around the body, you really start getting into a world where I walk up to my car and it unlocks automatically. I don't tell it to unlock, it just does it. And really context-aware applications and services around us that are making decisions on our behalf because it's the natural thing to happen. And so when you think about that in the broad context of where things can go, we see a huge amount of opportunity around every single application, everything we can go do. When that comes to making a product, at certain points in time, enabling technology gets to a place to say, hey, that idea that we had over here, it's now time to actually bring that to market. We can do it at a cost and a form factor in a product that actually will make sense for the market. So now let's go do that. And we have the bandwidth to go do that. And so, you know, that's why you've seen us move from headsets to, you know, speaker and audio to health is because when we look at the entire day, we see lots of things that you're doing and most of it has a lot of friction in it and a lot of bad products around it. We think that we have a unique element being, you know, a company that knows how to build technology around the body to essentially make those problems easier. And then, you know, certain times we, you know, we're ready to, we have the right technology to actually go do that.
So like looking to the future, I mean, focus is really important. So I'd say 99% of our day is focused on now and then kind of, you know, the next 6 months, what we're going to do. And, you know, it's very tactical. You want to build the next iteration of software as well as you can and the next iteration of hardware as well as you can. But we do have a vision. I mean, the vision is really important. You want to have that kind of the guiding light for the team of where we want to go. And, you know, that but yet that guiding light also changes. I mean, as you talk to more customers and as you talk to more consumers about what they want, what their experiences are with the products, you learn more. And you feed that right back into the company as to what new opportunities are out there. I mean, as Travis said, there's a lot of really crappy products out there, which gives us, you know it's a huge opportunity for new companies like us to go innovate.
Ran, how far are you thinking out?
I don't think we plan for, you know, exactly what we'll be doing in 5 or 10 years, but I think the way that Matt described it, you know, guiding light is really, really critical. And it's what you need in order to go through the ups and downs, which are inevitable in startups. And for us, for me, it's always started with, you know, photography, computer graphics, and a belief that the intersection of these two things is what will enable us to share pictures, better pictures with each other that show the people that we love, the things that we really care about. And I believe that that is something that has powered, you know, huge markets. It's driven human beings from when, you know, they walked out of, you know, the field or out of the hunt to go paint pictures in caves to the first daguerreotypes that we've had to these enormous companies that are just made to make, you know, movies that are completely, you know, virtual. I mean, our pursuit as human beings for new ways to tell stories of one another is, I think, just one of the things that's always driven us. And so, for me, it's intersecting that with the pictures that we take of our own lives and bringing the best technologies to bear on that to enable better visual storytelling is something that I could see doing for a very, very long time.
So, if each of you could give one piece of advice to a would-be entrepreneur, maybe a one-sentence piece of advice, what would it be?
The one-sentence part's hard. I think it's really stay true to the vision, your original idea. You're going to have lots of people saying no throughout that, and by definition, it's the entrenched market, but just stay true to that vision, and that's what will drive you.
Great.
It's 1,000 times harder than you think it is.
Mine's the exact opposite of Matt's. I tell you, the best advice I ever got was that you can do it. And I tell you, look, if I can do it, you can do it. When I started the company, I was a total academic. It's possible I didn't really know the definition of entrepreneurship. I mean, the word, you know. And I was not an entrepreneur, but somebody, this guy Manu Kumar, who was my office neighbor, told me, you can do it. If I can do it, you can do it. And it was very painful, but he was right. And so I tell you, if I can do it, you can do it too.
Well, thank you, panelists. Thank you, audience, for the great questions. And please use the feedback.